Act 1. An 11-year-old boy with a radio under his pillow, north of Baltimore, doesn't hear the following broadcast because it never airs.
Manager's Corner with Earl Weaver.
Hi, everybody. This is Earl Weaver with Manager's Corner. Today, I have Tom Moore, Oriole broadcaster, back on the show. And I understand Tom's been getting some mail with questions that supposedly I can answer. Now, what the fuck are some of these goddamn questions, Tom?
Well, first of all, Earl, George Moore from Baltimore is asking how much we feel the loss of Don Stanhouse.
Well, Don Stanhouse was an asshole. He had us in trouble, had the fucking bases loaded. God damn it, almost every fucking time he went out there, he liked to ruin my health smoking cigarettes, and thank God we got Timmy Stoddard coming in out of the bullpen right now, sticking a bat up their asses. And that's what it takes.
Well, Bill Whitehouse, Earl, that certainly is an answer. From Frederick, Maryland, wants to know why you and the Orioles don't go out and get some more team speed.
Team speed, for Christ's sake. You get fucking goddamn little fleas on the fucking bases, getting picked off, trying to steal, getting thrown out, taking runs away from you. You get them big cocksuckers that can hit the fucking ball out of the ballpark and you can't make any goddamn mistakes.
Well, certainly this show is going to go down in history, Earl. Terry Elliott of Washington, D.C., wants to know why you don't use Terry Crowley as a designated hitter all the time.
Well, Terry Crowley's lucky he's in fucking baseball, for Christ's sake. He was released by the Cincinnati Reds. He was released by the fucking goddamn Atlanta Braves. We saw that Terry Crowley could sit on his fucking ass for 8 innings and enjoy watching a baseball game just like any other fan, and has the ability to get up there and break one open in the fucking ninth. So if this cocksucker would mind his own business and let me manage the fucking team, we'd be a lot better off.
Well, certainly you've made your opinions known on the fans' questions about baseball, Earl, but let's get to something else. Alice Sweet from Norfolk wants to know the best time to put in a tomato plant.
Alice Sweet ought to be worried about where the fuck her next lay's coming from rather than where her next goddamn tomato plant's coming from. If she'd get her ass out of fucking bars at night and go hustling around the goddamn street, she might get a prick stuck in her once in a while. I don't understand where these questions are coming from, Tom. That's about it from Manager's Corner. Go fuck yourself and the fuck with your show coming up next on the Baltimore Oriole Baseball fucking network.
The Manager's Corner with Earl Weaver is heard 20 minutes before every Orioles regular season game and was sponsored by...
Stop!
Earl Weaver was what a manager ought to look like. Short, angry, florid, impatient, and tempered. A character. Like a great many managers.
In the middle of the 1968 season, the Baltimore Orioles got themselves a new manager, Earl Weaver, a former minor league second baseman who never learned how to hit. It was the beginning of one of the most successful managerial tenures in the modern age. Weaver was a brilliant psychologist. He loved to bait umpires to inspire his team. And he was thrown out of 91 games, a major league record.
Do it again, and I'll knock you right in your nose.
I didn't touch you.
You pushed your finger.
I did not. Now you're lying. You're lying.
No, you are.
You are lying.
You're a big liar.
You are a liar, Earl.
You are
a liar.
You are.
When you talk to Earl Weaver, he would put you right in the middle of the baseball situation that you wanted to talk about as a writer, and he would tell you everything that was involved. And usually when he was doing this, he would have taken, he would be stark naked in his office and eating a leg of chicken or something like this. But a little pint-sized man with no clothes on, talking baseball with his eyes all alight. Wonderful.
I'll always remember Earl sitting in the dugout before a game with a cigarette cupped in his hand like a little boy sneaking a smoke and his fingers all yellowed by the smoke, telling a story and not realizing that they were playing the national anthem. And after the national anthem, I apologized. I'm sorry, I'm still here. And he turned to me and he said, "Relax, kid, don't worry. We do this every day."
Under Weaver's leadership for 14 full seasons, the Orioles would win or come in second 12 times, win 4 pennants and 1 world championship.
Behind the rubber. Behind the rubber. He's got to go behind.
He did not go behind the rubber. He did. Listen to him. He did not.
No, I ain't listening to him, Eddie.
That's bull.
Behind the rubber.
Oh, bullshit.
Bullshit yourself.
You're here, and this crew is here just to fuck us.
Yeah.
Boom. Yeah, because you
good.
Put your finger
you
on
good.
Me.
I'm glad you hit me.
That's right. You're here for one goddamn specific reason.
What's that, Earl?
To fuck us.
Ah, oh, you're
yes,
full of shit. Fuck you.
Goddamn years and years. And don't you ever put your finger on me again.
You hit me, Earl.
You put your finger
that's
on me.
That's okay.
If you touch me,
I didn't. You ain't going to knock nobody on your ass.
You do it again and I'll knock you right in your nose.
I didn't touch you.
You pushed your finger.
I did
on
not.
Me.
Now you're
you
lying.
Goddamn it.
You're lying.
No, you are.
You are lying.
You're a big liar if you call
you are a liar, Earl.
You are
a liar.
You are. Chance tomorrow.
Oh,
you got it as quick as you can.
What is wrong with you?
You ain't no good.
No, you aren't either.
Yeah,
you
well,
aren't
you
either.
You ain't no good.
You're no fucking
you
good either.
Yeah, your ass will never have our games in
I hope. What do I care?
Yeah, what do I care? What are you doing here now?
Well, why don't you call the league office and ask him?
Yeah, I will.
Oh, good.
Don't think I won't.
Good. And the quicker you get out, it'll be better,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, yeah.
That's right.
You ain't going nowhere.
You aren't either.
You got 5, 10 fucking years to know who's in the Hall of Fame.
Oh, you're going to be in the Hall of Fame.
You know it.
Why?
You
We're
know it.
We're fucking up World Series?
You know it.
You're going to be in the Hall of Fame?
You know
up World
it. I've
Fame?
Won more than I've lost, kid.
I know you haven't.
Games. Count games. You don't even know what
you better get going, Earl.
I better get going.
You better get going.
Act 2. The 11-year-old boy has the radio under his pillow, but he's actually going to get to go to a game. Little did he know, one of the biggest highlights ever he'll only hear on the radio.
Isn't that what you think of when you see Doug DeSensei's? What a night that was. June 22nd, when Orioles magic was born. The Birds were down in the ninth, 5-4.
It was one of the first baseball games that I ever went to as a, I guess, 11-year-old. On a school had just gotten out, and it was mid-June, and the Orioles were like this kind of scrappy team that didn't have stars, but were fun to watch.
35,000 fans sounded like 50,000, roaring with enthusiasm.
1-1 by Chodick. Here's a fly ball.
Unfortunately, my parents decided that we should leave the game in about the seventh inning as the Orioles were behind by several runs. They hit the home run, I think, just above where we were sitting.
The home run electrified the town, compelling 45,000 fans to show up the next night to make it happen again, and it did. In the 10th inning, down 6-5, Eddie Murray blasted a 3-run homer, and that was only game one of a doubleheader. Terry Crowley delivered a game-winning hit on the 8th to sweep the Tigers and to sweep the Orioles fans off their feet.
At WFBR, the Baltimore station, which had just taken over broadcasting Orioles games that year for the first time from WBAL, which was this old, staid, boring kind of station in the 70s, and WFBR was this new upstart with a rowdy morning DJ, one of the first rowdy morning DJs, Johnny Walker, and he started cutting up mashups of Orioles highlights with the song You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet and others. So I started also cutting up radio recordings of the Orioles and mixing them with music and songs.
A precursor to these dramas had occurred 2 weeks before on a sunny Sunday against the Texas Rangers. Reliever Jim Kern, one of the league's best, entered in the ninth inning to preserve a 4-3 win. But a miracle comeback ruined his day. By the way, the Texas Rangers announcer just happened to be John Miller.
He has hit 335 home runs. He's going to bunt. Third base side. Kern has nobody to throw to. He throws it down the left field line. One run scores. Humphrey holds it third, and it's 4-3.
After a double play tied the score, the king of swing, Terry Crowley, batted.
Ninth inning, 4-4. The pitch, tried to right center. Oliver going back. It's all over. Baltimore wins it. Terry Crowley has won it in the ninth inning.
Ken Singleton enjoyed a terrific year with 35 homers and 111 RBI, and Mike Flanagan did his best bulldog imitation on the mound with a Cy Young Award-winning performance. It certainly looked like some kind of secret pact between Flanny and Singleton when 15 of Singy's 35 homers came in Flanny's stars.
It's got a chance. It's gone. Standing ovation for Singleton. Another home run in another Flanagan game.
The fans in 1979 were amazing. Leading the way was a bespectacled cab driver of ample girth and zeal, while Bill Hagee wore a cowboy hat and orange T-shirt. Like a shepherd,
he led his rowdy flock with inspired hosannas as his choir sang. Three-run homers were Earl Weaver's most famous weapon, but his secret weapon brought victory one hot August night. Doug DeSensei's led from first base, Eddie Murray from third. Pinch hitter Benny Ayala waited the two-out, two-strike pitch from Chicago's rookie southpaw, Guy Hoffman.
Here come the runners, and Eddie Murray is stealing home. The game is over! Eddie Murray steals home, and the Orioles steal...
The magic reigned, the fans poured, and the birds soared to the division championship.
Oriole magic was on display for the whole country in the first game of the American League playoffs against the California Angels. The magician was pinch hitter John Lowenstein, who waved his wand in the 10th inning.
Runners at first and second, Lowenstein sends a high fly ball down the left field line. It's a home run for John Lowenstein! Just gets in there, and the Orioles win game one of this five-game series. Lowenstein rounds third base. He's grabbed by
Stanhouse got the win, then in the second game, converted an eight-run cushion into a one-run win, aging his skipper. After losing game three, the Orioles sent Scott McGregor to the mound in search of their first pennant in 8 years.
Jimmy Anderson, number nine hitter, grounded into a double play his last time up. Bases loaded, one out.
The Orioles then padded the lead and coasted to an 8-0 pennant-winning shutout. So it was on to the World Series in a rematch of 1971. A bone-chilling rain forced a postponement of the first game at the stadium. The next day brought snow, but like reliable postal carriers, the two teams delivered the goods anyway. Mike Flanagan had a special delivery, going the distance to gain a one-run victory.
In the ninth, they had a runner on third, two outs, and Stargell again hitting. And I can remember saying to myself, you're going to throw this ball as hard as you can and hope, because he's a pretty darn good hitter. And I threw it hard as I could, and it was away, thank God, and he hit a fly ball to Belanger. I can still see him taking those little steps and catching it. And I think I had about a 160-pitch game, and it was over.
Bert Blyleven of the Bucks returned the favor in game two, but then the Birds prevailed in both games three and four. Game four showed Earl Weaver's deep depth and made his genius label stick for good. Ahead of his critics by innings, Weaver passed over his two key pinch hitters early in the game, anticipating the need for them later. And then when the time was right, John Lowenstein, then Terry Crowley, both came through to provide victory.
Ask them where they're going, they don't know.
Seemed the most magical baseball season an 11-year-old boy could ever hope for. Earl Weaver willed the team to the World Series with, I don't know what, he had a left field of platoon of Gary Reneke and John Lowenstein, hardly Hall of Famers, and this magical pinch hitter Terry Crowley. And in Game 4, they won with that combination, and it appeared to be destiny. And then they lost game five, and then they lost game six, and it was tied 3-3. And I can remember vividly sitting in my mother's car waiting for her to get out of work at the bank and listening to this song and trying to change the words so that it pretended to a Pirates loss and not an Orioles loss.
Can do. Everybody wants to touch somebody.
Shocked the Orioles and came back to overcome the three-game deficit. In the finale, it was Willie Pops Stargell who popped a pitch deep into the right field stands. Just like 1971, the Pirates prevailed in a heart-wrenching seven-game series.
Of course, I wasn't convinced. I didn't think it was Willie Stargell's home run that won the World Series for the Pirates. It was me listening to that Eagles song in the car on the radio that lost the World Series for the Baltimore Orioles.
A wonderfully magic season had come to an end, but emotions poured the next day when 250,000 fans flooded the streets of Baltimore to express thanks to their heroes for an enchanting, marvelous season. It cemented a love affair that would carry through many years of glory and also despair.
So alas, the Orioles lost the World Series that year, but the world got a radio artist, Tom Rowe. And I wasn't perhaps the only sound artist listening to the WFBR and Johnny Walker that year. The band Animal Collective released a record called Centipede HZ last year. And in the interviews, they've mentioned the how Baltimore radio was an influence on this concept record about radio. Here's me reading a bit of an interview from eMusic.com, where first interviewer Matthew Perpetua talks to David Avery Terror Portner and asks him, "You use radio and radio signals as a musical motif through this new record. It's also pretty explicit in the lyrics for Moonjock. What inspired all that? As we start to write songs and piece everything together, we get a feeling of where everything is going. That was a lot of the process of writing this record, just jamming and trying to figure out a sound. Moonjock came later, but I definitely had the idea that it would be inspired by driving around with my family when I was growing up. My brother was a radio DJ, so I kind of got into music through him. He'd give me a lot of tapes. Sometimes he'd make these mixes or just record stuff straight from his own airtime. I got into pop music from always hearing pop radio in the car, and there's all these radio identifications and that kind of thing, which always seemed real weird and cool to me. Like, I couldn't imagine something like Into the Groove by Madonna not having this other weird thing, a station ID coming after it, that would be on a tape my brother had. Or Interference, or just driving on I-95 and going from one town to the next and the radio's crossing signals. I remember talking to Brian about it, and Music Concrete Radio is a big sound source, so it's maybe kind of overdone or overstated, but I kind of like the idea of somehow using that vibe to make a more alien, like alien radio signals, and how the crossing of songs works with our aesthetic to begin with. How did you find the air checks that you used on the record, like Johnny Walker thing at the end of Rosie O? You can find them online. It's really easy. That one in particular was from a British pirate radio station where the DJ's name is actually Johnny Walker. There's a group of people that collect those air check tapes online, so I spent hours and hours listening to them. It was a little mind-bending. I tried to stick to stations that some of us might have heard, but eventually I had to stretch out to other markets. What were you looking for when you went through all those sounds? The sort of unintentional moments. I think DJs made them primarily to apply for future jobs, so there's a lot of stop, pause, record, where they cut out the music. You'll hear some idea, commercial, and then a song fade up, and it cuts to the outro of another song. So if you listen, you find a lot of these moments where the DJ made his own splice that created a cool moment. So I'd sample right around there.
We'll be right back. Come on, we'll be right back.
Act 3. The Baltimore-based band Animal Collective meets up with that 11-year-old boy 22 years later in a Williamsburg loft.
Thank you.
September, and that was Animal Collective performing at the Freewinder 3.9 space in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, early in the year 2001, one of their first shows in New York City, on a bill with Black Dice and Chick Chick Chick. You're listening to Freewinder 3.9 and Transmission Arts on WGXC 90.7 FM, Accra.